I next met with Dr. Paul Richardson from the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute in Boston, and to begin, he put in perspective recent research developments in multiple myeloma.
As you know, this has been such a dynamic field. We have no less than 21 FDA approvals in the last 14 years, which is unprecedented in any heme malignancy for sure. In fact, possibly even across the board. But that being said, the advances have, of course, resulted in a wonderful array of therapeutic options for providers to offer to their patients. I think the important point is, though, to sort of try and help frame that and understand how some of these new advances are going to impact on practice. So as a sort of couple of background points, Neil, I think, as we all know, multiple myeloma is clearly not just one disease. There is dramatic heterogeneity across the spectrum of the illness. But what's also very important to appreciate is that there is heterogeneity within the patient, not just between the patients. And in that context, there is this real need to sort of risk stratify and understand, as we individualize therapy with the array of new agents that we have, what we need to think about in terms of guiding principles. And I think what's nice to show, or hopefully helpful to share with MDs, is this, that essentially over time in the natural history of the disease in any one patient, the tempo of illness can change. So you have this clonal heterogeneity on the one hand, but also this ability of the disease to ebb and flow. And that's an incredibly important principle to understand as you manage your patient longitudinally with the illness. And our understanding of this biological process has become far more sophisticated over the last decade or so. I guess from a practical point of view, what it tells us is that it's important to throw a big net around this disease. And when treatment is appropriate, it needs to be principled on the idea that you have backbone drugs that constitute your framework, and then you rationally add to it with appropriate other drugs that may be specific in certain settings or advantageous in the sense that they are essentially mutationally or genetically agnostic.
Could I just clarify one point? I was interested by what you were saying about clonal heterogeneity. At any given point in time, let's say the newly diagnosed patients, is there evidence that there's different clones in the same patient?
Absolutely. Yes, there is. And the evidence for that has emerged over the last 5 or 6 years or so, with some really nice work from a variety of investigators illustrating this point. And I think, as you know, we sequence patients over time as patients are characterized when they participate in clinical trials in, you know, initial treatment studies followed by studies in the relapse setting, Neil, we've been able to start to understand this better. I think what's also very important is that, as we know, myeloma is truly a malignancy that's influenced by its microenvironment. And I think that's both the bone marrow milieu, but beyond that, it's cortical bone, the extramedullary compartment, and very importantly is our understanding now of how the immune system really impacts upon this, and that immune suppression in myeloma patients is ubiquitous. We've understood this for years because patients are so vulnerable to infection, but the implications in terms of tumor biology are huge. So it's kind of that spectrum of illness that people need to understand. But yes, the level of evidence is high, I think, Neil. Treating myeloma truly is a marathon. It's really not a sprint. One has to think about, obviously now, the asymptomatic space, which is becoming very exciting in terms of therapeutic opportunities, and clinical trials are really now very much an important aspect of the management of patients with smoldering myeloma. I think what's very critical to understand in the smoldering disease is that essentially this is an area that's relatively dynamic in terms of definition. And what we're beginning to increasingly see is that the so-called high-risk smoldering patient really now constitutes an active disease process which warrants therapy. And so some of the recent guidelines that have changed to reflect that, I think, are important in practice. However, I would stress these are guidelines, and every clinician should use their clinical judgment in assessing a patient whether or not they have active disease versus a more indolent process. And there's nothing better than careful follow-up to ensure that process can be as accurate as possible. Now, when we think about this issue of heterogeneity, I do want to share that with you in a bit more detail, Neil. But essentially what we've come to appreciate is that these evolve over time. There are selection pressures both from actually the biology of the illness and indeed from therapy. And this clonal evolution can indeed result not only in progression, but it also explains the complexity of the resistance mechanisms that exist. So I think that this is an important concept to grasp because it provides a very strong rationale to this idea of a series of backbone drugs to which you then rationally add and build appropriate other agents in combination to improve outcome.
You know, I was thinking about this project we're doing in CLL, looking at the issue of 17p deletion and how a lot of patients acquire that with time. Made me think a little bit about what you are talking about here with myeloma. You talked about kind of what the pressures are that change on this. From a clinical point of view, do you think that we're going to move into a situation where maybe, for example, at first relapse, we're going to be looking as closely at the tumor, even genomically, as we do up front, and that as you move down the line, you'll continue to be taking new looks at the tumor?
Neil, you're spot on, as always. That's exactly right. In fact, I would argue it's more relevant to know where you are down the line than it is initially if you're kind of thinking about things across the spectrum, because at the end of the day, where your patient is right now may be radically different from where they were 3 years ago at diagnosis. So this concept of assessing patients with cytogenetics and FISH at each restaging point is very, very valid and a very important one, and I'm glad you raise it.
Do you do that clinically?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. So in other words, we assess patients at diagnosis, then at first relapse, second relapse, and beyond. And cytogenetics can seriously influence therapeutic choices now because we know, for example, in the proteasome inhibitor space that a PI is essential if you're dealing with 17p deletion. We know that that really matters. And some of the most exciting data we'll come to in a moment, which is around the use of exazomib in this setting because it gives you the ability to longitudinally control those clones. But I think it's one example, Neil. Obviously, the monoclonal antibodies are another one, and cofilzomib and so on. And we'll come to all of that in a moment. But I think it brings us beautifully to the construct that multimodality targeting of myeloma in the context of the bone marrow microenvironment is essential. You can see, obviously, we need to target the cortical bone. We have the excitement not only with the well-established bisphosphonates in the aminobisphosphonate compartments, such as zoledronic acid and pamandronic acid, but now, of course, we have the really provocative data of denosumab in this setting, showing even clinical benefit in a randomized phase 3 trial in favor of denosumab over the standard, which is zoledronic acid. Certainly in practice terms, the use of denosumab in renal disease seems to be very important. And my colleague, Anupa Raja, has led that work. And really, it's fascinating to see how denosumab, I think, will impact on practice going forward, recognizing, of course, that zoledronic acid is the gold standard with pomidronate as an important other option as well.
Just out of curiosity, can you tease out how bone-targeted agents, exactly what they're doing? And does it go beyond our classic concept of what we think it's doing? Does it interfere with the myeloma process itself?
Yeah, it's a great question, Neil. I think what's so exciting about the bisphosphonate space has been recent data from a variety of laboratories, including our own, showing that zoledronic acid influences actually the immune milieu. And there's clear evidence from a variety of labs now that gamma-delta T cells are stimulated by bisphosphonates. And this is dynamic. It's not a static process, which is another very important argument for caregivers to understand that whilst we recommend bisphosphonates monthly for the first 2 years and then kind of a wait and see afterwards, certainly in my practice, I'm a firm believer in every 3 months, even in patients in complete remission, because not only is the bone, in my view, a barrier to long-term disease control, I think it's a sanctuary site for disease in my own view, but also with that immunological story, it helps us understand why, for example, in the UK myeloma 9 trial, Gareth Morgan and colleagues were able to actually demonstrate a survival benefit to zoledronic acid over a less potent bisphosphonate, which was unexpected in that study.
In terms of the immune effect, do you see the same immune effect with denosumab?
That's a great question. And I think at this juncture, I'm not sure that we entirely know. I would argue that it's possible, but given the biology, one might argue that it is something we need to better understand before we make that leap of faith.
Just a quick follow-up question about HDAC inhibitors, because you've been very involved with that research. And I don't know, to me, it's kind of like clinically, yes, vanabinostat's approved, but it hasn't really been, you know, kind of like the kind of hit that some of these other types of agents have done, monoclonal antibodies, et cetera. Do you think that maybe there's more potential in that mechanism that in the future it'll be an more important part of myeloma therapy, or is it maybe?
Yeah, Neil, I firmly believe it. I think penobinostat was the sort of proof of principle. I also happen to feel that vorinostat was also a promising agent. But penobinostat obviously achieved FDA approval. And, you know, if you think back to the Panorama study, the progression-free survival benefit to those patients in the three-drug platform compared to the two-drug control in whom prior bortezomib and IMiD exposure had resulted in therapeutic failure, the PFS benefit in those patients was almost 8 months. So when you have that kind of PFS difference, and that's in a phase three randomized placebo-controlled trial, so you really have a level of evidence that's strong that something's going on. The challenge with panobinostat, of course, has been better understanding how to manage some of the toxicities. And I think we've got there. We know that you can go to lower doses, for example. We know that if you administer bortezomib weekly, subcutaneously, with appropriate hydration, a lot of the toxicity, particularly the GI side effects, are much, much less. But I think what's really exciting, Neil, is the new next generation HDACs, and of course the AC241 compound, I think is a very, very important new advance, and it's an exciting new advance because it's very well tolerated in my experience. I participate in the studies with other investigators, and having been working with Pano and now working with 241 extensively, I'm very impressed that it's a step in the right direction. So I'm very hopeful that that agent will fulfill its potential as well. What's exciting about them as a whole class, Neil, is several things. One, that they're not only epigenetically critical, i.e. stabilizing this highly unstable genome that is the hallmark of myeloma, but they're also very important in terms of things that you might not expect. Obviously, there's this agrosomal target, which is important in bortezomib and proteasome-mediated resistance. But beyond that, there's an immunological effect that may be less appreciated. There's the upregulation of CD38 expression by this class of drug, and that makes it obviously a very attractive partner with some of our most important antibodies. So I think that, frankly, the opportunity for the HDAC class to do more for myeloma patients is very real.
I keep thinking of all these questions I want to ask you, but that's fascinating. I didn't know about the upregulation of CD38. Is there a correlation between the amount of CD38 expression and benefit from daratumumab? And are you thinking that maybe there's a synergy between, say, HDAC inhibitors and something like daratumumab?
Absolutely, Neil. Yeah, I do believe that. I think that there's clear evidence with the daratumumab therapy that you can run out of clinical benefit over time if you reduce schedule. You know, you go to a situation where you're infusing less frequently, you go from weekly to two weekly to monthly, and there is evidence that lower levels of CD38 expression are associated with lower degrees of response. Strategies that upregulate CD38 aren't just, however, limited to HDAC inhibition. They include simple maneuvers, such as even cyclophosphamide, for example, can do that. So there are a number of ways you can think about optimizing responsiveness to CD38 targeting. And I think for our folks on the call, the important message is frequency of administration matters. Be careful about becoming too infrequent. Two, that in the efforts to improve responsiveness to CD38 targeting, the use of other drugs rationally. Obviously, the IMiDs are a knockout. Bortezomib has been very helpful. Clearly, carfilzomib shows similar promise. There are studies now looking at ixazomib in combination with daratumumab in press or in process even. And at the same time, of course, the HDAC idea, I think, is very compelling, as is the use of conventional chemotherapeutics like cyclophosphamide.
I guess the other thing is, I don't want to get too far off track, but I have to ask you in terms of other things that might contribute to, say, the effectiveness of daratumumab. I am curious about your thoughts about subcutaneous daratumumab because, I don't know, it seems like that has the potential to change, I don't know, kind of when the patient's exposed to the drug and how high levels, et cetera. It's just a completely different approach.
Yes, it's exciting. And I think it's very important for patients to improve the convenience of administration and so optimize frequency of administration and so forth. And I think it's promising. I think there are a couple of things one just has to be a little bit careful about. You know, it has a hyaluronidase vehicle built into it to allow breakdown of tissue so that there's absorption of the antibody. Patients, in my experience, have reported that it's generally very well tolerated. It's surprisingly so because it's a fairly substantial volume of antibody injected under the skin. I think one just has to be a little careful as we go forward with combinations because realizing that you've got steroids in the mix, you've got obviously proteasome inhibitors, you've got immunomodulatory agents that could stimulate the immune system. And we just have to be careful, I think, as we go into combinations with the sub-Q approach, what kind of local reactions we see. Having said that, I'm very hopeful that it'll pan out, because certainly data so far suggests that it's working very well. I think it's important, though, Neil, to note that we've got other antibodies in the same space targeting the same antigen. And of course, isatuximab is a very promising antibody. Shorter infusion time, has different characteristics in terms of some of the pathways it's activating. And in my experience, has been both well tolerated and is exquisitely active. And it's basically a 2-hour infusion every couple of weeks. So there's a lot of work going on to help us better understand what we have to offer our patients. And I think, Neil, this would be very familiar to you. It'll be analogous to the CD20 space. We'll have a variety of antibodies we can choose from in the long term.
And, you know, surprisingly, it looks like, you know, maybe obinutuzumab in some situations might be more effective than rituximab, which I think people thought never was going to happen.
Right.
What about this new agent? Is it the main one? Is this the, what you think is going to be next up? And how long do you think it'll be before it might become available? What's it called again?
It's isatuximab.
Isatuximab.
Isatuximab, and we're currently conducting a phase 3 trial of isatuximab Pom-Dex versus Pom-Dex in relapsed refractory patients. And at the same time, our initial data with isatuximab Pom-Dex multicenter trial, my co-principal investigator is Dr. Joe McHale from the Mayo. Basically, we've seen wonderful results in this setting so far. And I think that it's, again, showing great promise.
What about single agent activity?
Yeah, it's real. Tom Martin from UCSF has led that work, and there's clearly monotherapy activity that's equivalent to daratumumab. I think what we all feel, because, you know, I'm a huge fan of Dara, it's never, of course, a zero-sum game. The more, the better, basically. But I think for us who've worked with both antibodies, both Dara and isatuximab, I've certainly been impressed that isatuximab has this advantage of an infusional time that's much shorter, actually. And also from the nursing perspective and patient perspective, certainly I've been impressed that it's a well-tolerated antibody and the infusional reaction rate is really very favorable.
That's really fascinating. Any projections or guesses when we might see data from the phase 3 trial?
Oh, yeah. Well, it's moving along quickly. As you can imagine, it's in a high-risk space, so because it's for relapsed refractory disease. And so as a result of that, I think we'll get a signal relatively quickly in the next couple of years from it, because it's enrolling robustly. It's a big international trial. But I have to say that I think if we get a signal from that, it is, as I understand it, a SPA, so it will lead to an FDA approval. But I'm very impressed, for example, that daratumumab plus Pom Dex was approved by the FDA off of a single-arm phase 2, and I do applaud the FDA for that, because they obviously felt comfortable that this robustness of response signal that they saw, as well as the PFS from the single-arm trial, warranted approval. And that's great for patients, because it means there's real access to daratumumab, pomalidomide, and Dex. And as you know, Neil, these approvals are so vital, because at the end of the day, especially in the current healthcare environment, insurance companies and payers are, I think, quite entitled to say, where's the evidence? And when you have an FDA approval, there's no better evidence than that. So I particularly applaud the FDA for their proactive approach, because it really does improve access for our patients to really important combinations.
Anything else you want to say about novel agents?
Well,
I mean, I guess we could go on for the next couple of hours, but...
We could. I was just going to say, when do the bars open, Neil? Yeah. No. No. I mean, I'd love to say simply that, you know, the good news for providers is lots of things going on. But you're right, Neil. That sort of generates the problem of, goodness me, what do we do? Multiple options are now available to treat both newly diagnosed and relapsed refractory myeloma. And how do we sequence therapies to ensure the best outcomes for our patients? And this is adapted from a paper that my colleague and partner, Dr. Jacob Laubach, and others published just last year. But the important point is, in Jacob's paper, what he was really trying to drive at was, how do we make sense of all the options that we have? And you've got first, second, and third line choices. And I think, again, as I said earlier, the important message for providers, it's not a zero-sum game. It's not one versus the other. I think one really sort of can make choices, and that you can revisit drug classes repeatedly. You can revisit the same drug as long as you bring it together with a rational combination. I want to sort of make here a very clear emphasis on the other most important approved antibody in our space, which is elotuzumab, a very important partner drug with IMiDs and indeed also proteasome inhibitors, and certainly a very well-tolerated antibody. You just have to be a little careful about this infection signal, but I do think in our experience, certainly, it's been very manageable.
Hold on, infection signal? What's that?
Good question here. Well, what we saw in the Eloquent studies was there were slightly higher incidences of infection with elotuzumab, chest infections and so forth. And in a recent upfront study that Jacob led of RVD plus ELO robust responses, but a couple of septic episodes, which may reflect, including some mortality in association with these, unfortunately, and very sadly. But important message for providers is that be careful about steroid premedication, infectious risk in our patients, especially in newly diagnosed patients where actually the immune paresis can be profound.
Are these neutropenic infections?
No, interesting enough, not necessarily, Neil, no. I mean, again, immune paresis is profound in myeloma, and so you can have an absolute neutrophil count that seems more reassuring, but in reality, because you don't have competent immunoglobulin, these patients are basically as vulnerable as your classical neutropenic. So, important message, you know, be careful, and if in doubt, treat. And I think the important point is that the use of immunoglobulin supplementation to augment uninvolved immunoglobulin levels is clearly valid for any patient who has recurrent infections, for sure. But I think ELO really has promise. I mean, I firmly believe that. We use it in the maintenance setting now, and we use it earlier, and we have lovely data from the smoldering space with it. And it's truly an immunoadjuvant, as you know, Neil, through its effect on SLAMF7 and its stimulation of natural killer cells.
So hold on a second. You said in the maintenance setting, are you talking about outside a trial?
Well, I think we sometimes do this, and I'll be perfectly candid if I may. I think it's not an inappropriate use of the drug at all.
I mean, it makes a lot of sense for sure.
Yeah. Well, there are maintenance trials ongoing, but what we typically will do is if you've got a patient now on the gold standard, which is lenalidomide maintenance until progression in whichever setting, be it transplant or not, if you see biochemical progression and for whatever reason a proteasome inhibitor might not be an ideal choice, elotuzumab integrated with IMID for biochemical progression, we've seen A, is well tolerated, and B, frankly, makes great sense. You're essentially augmenting the immune system to improve further immune surveillance in the maintenance setting because you're synergizing with your IMID to provide that extra level of cellular immune activity that you need. And because it's very well tolerated, in my experience, it's a very reasonable thing to do, I think, especially if, for example, you know, a patient has neurotoxicity or some vascular risk that might make either bortezomib or carfilzomib a less attractive add-on. Obviously, when you've got lenalidomide as the backbone, Neil, you can always think about moving to POM, or pomalidomide, I should say, to be more complete. But, you know, at the end of the day, sometimes it's very nice to have POM in reserve for the next step. So, you know, adding ELO at that point may make sense.
It's interesting, though, that when you brought up that term, it kind of caught my attention of ELO as maintenance.
Yep.
And, I mean, technically, what you're saying is kind of early progression, being very aggressive. Of course, that has been a scenario that people have talked a lot about since ELO was approved. But just to be clear, though, in those kind of patients, you have them on len maintenance, and you start to kind of see they're going to progress, they're progressing biochemically. Do you also usually bump up the dose of len?
Well, it's a great question, Neil, and some people do that. Some folks like to add steroid. I'm more cautious about adding steroid. I think that in the short term may make sense, but long term obviously becomes more of an issue. Bumping up the len dose is perfectly reasonable as long as the patient's tolerating the len. But I think as you think about the strategy, one has to just be aware of tolerability issues. And one constant challenge with len, especially as monotherapy in the absence of steroid and over the long haul, is this so-called bile acid malabsorption diarrhea, which we actually first noticed back in 2009 or so, before that actually, when we were doing monotherapy studies with lenalidomide in the relapsed refractory space, and we saw this diarrhea emerge. And from some really nice input from our GI colleagues, you know, basically treat it as if it's sort of like a GVHD, give cholestipol to bind bile acid and see what happens. And sure enough, we saw responses. And of course, there was a very elegant report from the Marsden group where they basically showed that this was indeed a bile acid malabsorption process. And whilst it was a small series of patients, it was a very nice proof of principle.
Did you say GVHD?
To be clear, Neil, what I mean by that is that lenalidomide is clearly an immune stimulator. So basically what happens is you get a degree of immune stimulation in the gut. So your gut immunity is enhanced. And so just to give you the reason why on earth did we start using cholestipol empirically back in 2009, because as a center, for example, we obviously have a very busy transplant program and they have an allo component. And basically graft versus host disease of the gut can sometimes be helped with the use of cholestipol or a bile acid binding agent. So our GI experts who were giving us guidance on how to manage this lenalidomide-related diarrhea suggested this might be a strategy.
What's the actual agent that you use?
It's cholestipol, 1 to 2 grams. It's given before meals. It's a bile acid binding agent. It helps with cholesterol as well, interesting enough. But it really works in about 2/3 to 3/4 of cases in whom you use it. And the classic clues for our providers to hear that someone's getting what we call Revy belly for short, but a basically lenalidomide-related diarrhea, is that they'll report that their diarrhea occurs after eating, about half an hour later. It's associated with gassiness, and it's particularly exacerbated by the consumption of fatty food, which obviously triggers more bile acid release. So that's a clue.
I know I heard about this recently, and I'm dying to poll people about it because I'm wondering if people have heard about this. I hadn't heard about it. I think it's fascinating. And this GVHD thing is really fascinating.
Well, yes. I think one, I don't want to get ahead of myself there, but just to simply for folks to understand the principle. The principle is that you're stimulating your gut immunity,
right.
Your gut's turned on, and then basically bile acid drops onto the intestinal mucosa, and there's a little diarrhea that follows. For patients, though, it can be an absolute devil, and it can be very, very challenging from a quality of life point of view.
Well, I never thought I'd be asking you this question, but I was so curious because I saw that ibrutinib was just approved for GVHD, right?
Yes.
Which is like, where did that come from? So where did that come from? I assume it's some kind of immune effect of ibrutinib. And is this just in allo? Or, for example, what about solid tumor transplants?
Well, I think probably both. That's fascinating data. I agree with you. And just to give you a little clue, my colleague Jacob Laubach and the Alliance, which we're part of, is leading a trial of ibrutinib, lenalidomide and dexamethasone in myeloma, and we're hoping to open fairly soon. His
wow.
partner, Yvonne Efebera from OSU, is also part of that team.
What do we know about ibrutinib and myeloma to start with? I'm not sure I've heard.
It's positive. Basically, we've published our work there.
As a monotherapy?
Yeah. Yeah, with
you
dex.
See responses to ibrutinib and myeloma.
Yes, it's
wow.
It's not a knock'em sock'em signal, to be honest with you, Neil, but it's a signal that's real and continuous therapy and disease control over the long haul. So we're quite pleased, and the combination strategies that are going forward are several. There's ibrutinib plus len, which Jacob's leading, and the idea is just as you touched on, we want to get some information that could then potentially inform maintenance strategies, and then at the same time, there's ibrutinib pomalidomide being pursued, as well as other studies looking at ibrutinib and a proteasome inhibitor.
And is this ibrutinib as a BTK inhibitor or as an immune agent?
Well, essentially both. I mean, it's a BTK is the target in myeloma, obviously, but the fact is that some of its immune stabilization effects in the gut may become relevant to improving tolerability as an all-oral combination in patients over the long term with the immunomodulator backbone. So I think that there's real value to these interesting combinations of approved drugs because they can provide us real options when you're facing the continuum of challenges that we know. If you think about what targets in myeloma we're after, they're genomic abnormalities, targeting and overcoming mutations, the critical role of combination therapy, very much, Neil, the evolving position and timing of transplant. And this is a very important area. And then, of course, an absolute fundamental in myeloma management now, the importance of continuous treatment. And then in terms of the research space, we're looking obviously at next generation agents that target protein degradation, not only proteasome inhibitors, but also upstream and downstream of the proteasome. And then, of course, the real breakthrough of the last couple of years, which has been the realization that restoring anti-myeloma immunity really matters and that the antibodies have led that charge. And now, of course, we have the checkpoint inhibitors and potentially also the therapeutic opportunity afforded by vaccines. We have, obviously, the types of immunotherapy and immuno-oncologic agents that are emerging, and the antibodies are arguably passive. And I include here not only antibodies, but I should emphasize the role of checkpoint inhibitors in this space. And then the active ones, of course, include not just the vaccines I just touched on, but the real excitement around chimeric antigen receptor T cells, CAR T cell technology, which really, of course, is very exciting in heme malignancy broadly. But in myeloma now, we have some very provocative data with the BCMA target that is suggesting that this incredibly interesting and, I think, exciting approach can have great promise for patients. But I think we have to be a little cautious here. It's very much what I would call an early phase process at this moment. We have early data, which is driven by essentially numerator experiences. And what I mean by that is for, every 50 or 60 patients potentially considered for a CAR-T program, 10 to 20 will actually get through. And then in that context, you'll see remarkable results. But that, of course, just has to bear in mind that this is not necessarily a off-the-shelf technology at this point, far from it. It's also extremely expensive. So I think we have to just be a little bit careful about the enthusiasm for it to simply say it's a great new direction, very exciting. When one thinks of it in the big spectrum, I think it's going to be incredibly exciting for patients to have more access to this approach, particularly as we realize some of the limitations of autologous transplant. So arguably, in my view, CAR-T technology may replace autologous transplant in the long term. I may be wrong, but it seems like a reasonable hypothesis. But I think we also shouldn't lose sight of the fact that off-the-shelf antibodies, be they biphenotypic or otherwise, really, and that's an exciting area in itself, that may provide us with real promise going forward.
More from a pragmatic point of view, you mean?
Yes, exactly. Because at the end of the day, for your community practice patient who's in the Midwest, who perhaps is a lovely person who would rather come to clinic once every 2 weeks or once a month and receive an immunotherapy, obviously the monoclonal antibodies lead the charge with an IMiD backbone, proteasome inhibitor, etc. And that's the sort of person who might be a little older too, in whom a CAR-T technology may make very little sense. So I think the important point is that there are numerous options. And I think the reality of CAR-T is that it's probably, in my view, been the most exciting step in transplantation-type biology for myeloma that we've seen, recognizing its uniqueness in that sense.
Just to clarify, though, from a clinician's point of view, from a practical point of view right now, although, of course, right now this product's not been approved, but who knows when that would happen.
Yeah.
To me, it kind of reminds me, like, for example, the, what's it called, AxiCell CD19
yes.
agent for diffuse large B-cell, where they've seen people with very advanced disease, no options, have tremendous clinical responses. Is that kind of where you think myeloma is going to start out as a post, approved strategy that really ought to be considered by fairly good performance status patients?
Right, exactly. And I think that that's probably where the field is going pretty quickly, actually. But just an element of caution, though, because at the end of the day, what we're seeing with this approach is that there are significant toxicities, the cytokine release syndrome being one. The responses are dramatic. In our own practice, we've obviously got a very active CAR-T program. It's being led by my colleague Nikhil Munshi, and the studies that we're working with Nikhil on, we're seeing patients have really dramatic responses. But they're highly selected, Neil. For example, in my own practice, I have a number of my patients who were lining up for CAR-T therapy, and literally waiting lists can be as long as 6 months. You can imagine how that impacts on outcome, because obviously patients who have more challenging disease will obviously need to go on to other therapies in the interim and get cracking with better salvage strategies that are immediately available to them. So you can see, can't you, Neil, how that could influence some of your data output, because essentially you're selecting a very specific population. It doesn't detract, though, from the fact that you've got a penta-refractory patients whom other agents have failed them who clearly benefit. So I think real promise, but you're right, Neil, once it's approved, it'll give us another important string to the bow. But again, I personally am very struck that we also see dramatic responses for patients with daratumumab, the checkpoint inhibitors, some of the next generation proteasome inhibitors. These agents really provide a fascinating platform going forward.
I think that's a really good point. One other issue you mentioned in terms of toxicity, both the cytokine release as well as the neurologic toxicity, I've kind of heard that in the myeloma situation with the BCMA, there's not as much of that. Is that the case?
Yes, I think that's to some extent, it's not so severe, I guess, is the point. What we've seen in our own BCMA experience is that it's there, but it's manageable. And in fact, some of the data from the UPenn group support that. And this recent presentation at ASCO from the Chinese suggested, same signal. They definitely saw the toxicity. They had a fairly larger cohort of patients to report on. But again, if you look at the nitty-gritty of how they reported it, 35 patients in, actually 19 or so evaluable for a response, 100% response rate in those evaluable for response, but the remaining 11 were not evaluable. So when you look at data like that, again, I think the importance is tremendous promise, beautiful science that underpins it. But again, is it prime time? Not yet. Let's see.
You also mentioned therapeutic vaccines. Where are we with that strategy?
I think those show great promise too, and I especially want to acknowledge my colleague David Avigan at the Beth Israel, who's led lovely work with the dendritic cell fusion vaccine in this area as a post-transplant strategy, and there's now a CTN randomized trial looking at this approach with an IMID backbone, in this case lenalidomide, to better evaluate its impact post-transplant, and I think those data are really promising. There are also very exciting vaccines that we're deploying earlier in the illness, in the smoldering space. And these are peptide-targeting vaccines, which are very, very promising, I think, combined with some of the newer immunotherapeutics, not least of which are checkpoint inhibitors and IMIDs. And these provide what I think is fascinating, actually, the ability for memory. In other words, that you can educate your T cells for a long-term immune surveillance in smoldering patients or even arguably in MGUS and then be able to go forward. The important point about the antibodies is that they're agnostic to mutational thrust, it would seem. And obviously, we have next-generation IMIDs that are very important to mention. These include not only pomalidomide, but just so you know, Neil, on the horizon, these new cell mods, which we're studying now in phase 1 and 2, and they are really promising. They are oral agents. They're on the IMID platform, but they're much more potent and they're much more selective.
What are they again?
They're so-called cell mods.
Could you just clarify, though? I'm still not. Is this a new IMID or a class or what?
Yeah, no, it is. It's in the IMID class, and they're so-called cell mods. They're built on the IMID platform. So
cell mods?
Yeah, cell mods. C-E-L-L-M-O-D-S, cell mods.
And what are they?
Well, they're, again, in the IMID family, and they're basically very specific and very potent, and they build on the success of thalidomide, lenalidomide, and pomalidomide, and there are a whole class of them that have been further refined, and they are really very, very, very promising in my view.
Huh. Are any of them specifically, have we seen, you know, phase 1 or 2 data on it?
Yeah, the data currently hasn't been presented, but Saga's leading one of the key compounds, and we'll be spearheading another. So it's kind of work in process, but it's exciting. And I share it with you simply to say the future is looking very bright, particularly when you then think about how you integrate it with immune function, as we've discussed.
That's only like the 10th thing you've said that I never heard before.
Well, Neil, it's my pleasure. But dropping down a little bit, obviously beyond the antibodies and the vaccines, I do want to emphasize that we also have new proteasome inhibitors. And one that perhaps has been under the radar screen for a while is merizumib. And this is a beta-lactone that targets the beta-5, beta-1, and beta-2 subunits all in one. It's unique in that regard. And it's very exciting. It's been developed actually in brain tumors because in the original phase 1 we did with merizumib and myeloma, we noticed some CNS side effects that were manageable but real. And we therefore hypothesized that this must be crossing the blood-brain barrier, which the other proteasome inhibitors don't. And sure enough, it does. And it went to modeling in GBM, and it's very active.
Huh.
So now it's in clinical trial, and those are going very well in glioblastoma.
IV?
It's an IV, but it has an oral preparation as well. So it's got the promise of oral bioavailability and activity as well. But in myeloma, frankly, Neil, it's active when we combine it with POM. And it's also very excitingly effective in CNS myeloma, which is obviously a rare bird, thank God, because it's extremely difficult to treat. But it's becoming more frequent. As patients live longer, the CNS involvement with myeloma is increasing. And so we actually published a case for a series in the British Journal of Hematology this year, where we showed that merizumib in combination with other drugs was effective in CNS myeloma. So
what's the usual, you know, is it meningitis or?
Yeah, it's typically leptomeningeal spread. Interesting enough, myeloma prefers that. It's like lymphoma in that regard to solid plasmacytoma within the parenchyma of the brain. That's vanishingly rare. But leptomeningeal spread of disease is not. And that basically is uncommon, thank goodness. But to say that it's unseen is not correct. The frequency of CNS myeloma, I think, is clearly increasing as patients live longer with the illness.
Just out of curiosity, about how many people in your practice right now have leptomeningeal myeloma?
In our group, we have probably at this any one time, we have 3 or 4 patients affected by it. Obviously, their prognosis can be very challenging. We typically use craniospinal radiation. In terms of intrathecal therapy, the only effective agents really are intrathecal thiotepa, which is not easy to access. It's an alkylator, obviously. But we do then use whatever you have. Could it be Ara-C? Unfortunately, methotrexate you can use, but it's not particularly active in my experience. And obviously, use dexamethasone.
Have you had any patients like that who you gave this other proteasome inhibitor to?
Right. Well, exactly. This was the case series that we published in British Journal. And again, it's just a couple of cases, but the principle was the point that you could administer mirizumab. It does cross the blood-brain barrier. And in these cases that we reported, there was activity seen. So it's a future direction.
You see clinical improvement?
Oh, absolutely. Both clinical and radiological.
Radiological also.
Yeah.
Wow, that's fascinating.
Yeah. And also based on cell count as well.
Do you think it's possible that, or likely that there may be significant numbers? Doesn't sound like it if you guys only have three or four patients, but what I was going to say is that people are missing it.
Great question. Again, fortunately, it's rare because it's not easy to treat and it's lethal. But the fact is that as patients live longer, this is going to be an increasing challenge, in my view, as a sanctuary site. But I think independent of the CNS indication, and I think, frankly, mirizumab is probably going to be approved for glioblastoma, actually, as the first proteasome inhibitor in that space. Yes, I would speculate it is, because it's going into phase three studies. And in that context, it's exquisitely active.
Do you see objective responses with GBM?
Yes, absolutely.
Wow.
The important point is that mirizumab is also, and I think this is the important point in myeloma for folks to hear, obviously it works in myeloma systemically. And what in our trial that we published, we showed that even after bortezomib and carfilzomib failure, basically Mariz could help patients and restore response. And the science behind that's strong because it affects beta 5, beta 1, and beta 2. It covalently binds those subunits. Now, why that's relevant, Neil, is this. Because when you inhibit beta 5, which is what exazomib, bortezomib, and carfilzomib do, beta 1 and beta 2 get upregulated to compensate for the beta 5 inhibition. Mirizumib has the value of hitting all three.
Wow.
So there's real science behind why it may be a, as it were, you know, when lenalidomide fails a patient, when you use pomalidomide, for example, if, say, bortezomib failed a patient or carfilzomib failed a patient, then mirizumib would be your next go-to.
What are they thinking in terms of when it might get approved for GBM?
Great question. I believe in the next few years we'll see that. I think so. The idea for applying it in CNS tumors came from us, actually. But in terms of the actual clinical development, that's in process.
That's so fascinating. I'm so happy to hear that about GBM. What a tough situation right now.
Neil, I completely agree with you. GBM is a hideous disease, and I think that they need a biological agent, and proteasome inhibition biologically makes great sense in GBM. So the fact we've got one that can punch into the disease is critical. So I agree with you. I think it's very promising.
You want to talk about this patient, or you want to keep talking about the other stuff?
Well, if you don't mind, if we can go back to that, because I just want to conclude a couple of points. I really wanted to make some points about, obviously, a variety of new targeted agents. We've got the targeting of the 1114 translocation with venetoclax, which is very exciting. We'll come to that in a moment in some closing comments. But I also want to make a comment about the nuclear transport inhibition, the SINE inhibitor, because basically that's, of course, selinexor. And that's showing great promise. And finally, there's a new chemotherapeutic, so-called melflufen, which is basically a peptidase avid next-generation form of melphalan, which basically spares some of the stem cell toxicity that you see with classical melphalan and also some of the classical toxicity of melphalan, be it mucositis and so on. What melflufen does, and it's a compound out of the Karolinska Institute in Sweden, is it targets the myeloma more specifically through peptidase activation. And in that context, the melflufen data have been really, I would argue, surprisingly positive. When I say surprisingly, that may sound a little bit sort of, wow, why? Well, actually, it sort of makes sense. In the myeloma space, when immunotherapies and proteasome inhibition and so on have failed our patients, there's a subgroup of patients we've consistently seen have been responsive to chemotherapeutics. And perhaps the best clue came from when carfilzomib was put up against cyclophosphamide in the FOCUS trial. Remarkably, that was a negative study. I don't think that was any ding against the carfilzomib, frankly, because I think using a single agent in the relapse refractory space is very hard. But I think what it showed is that there are a subgroup of patients who are chemotherapeutically responsive. And melflufen has sort of filled that bill in a series of clinical trials that we've done now, where after IMID failure, after proteasome inhibitor failure, melflufen has generated a solid response rate in combination with dexamethasone at around 35%. And that's after, you know, these are in double, triple, quadruple refractory patients. So that's a promising signal. So just to mention melflufen, and obviously in that same breath, selinexor, really interesting data, particularly in combination with bortezomib, where it does appear to be, again, active in patients with penta-refractory disease, which again shows the value of being very sort of broad-minded as we think about this disease.
Could you just clarify that before you go on? I kind of like the name melflufen. It kind of has a little bit of a maybe Scandinavian feel. But what is that? It's a pill? What does it do?
Oh, no, it's intravenous.
Okay.
And it's called J1 by generic. It's basically, that was the original number of it, and it became melflufen. It's a next-generation melphalan. It's built on the melphalan backbone.
Oh, interesting.
But what it essentially does is it's peptidase avid. So what happens is, in myeloma, the cells are packed with peptidases. You know, stem cells, other tissues, less so. So there's an avidity that takes it up. So in a sense, it's a targeted therapeutic because there's preferential uptake into the myeloma. What's really exciting about it, Neil, is it doesn't seem to cause mucositis. It does cause myelosuppression. I want to be very clear about that.
But it's like a chemotherapeutic agent?
Oh, yes. It's a classic alkylator class of drug. Yeah.
Wow.
The point is, and that was my posit, that you see patients be responsive to chemotherapeutics long into their illness. And this subgroup of patients seem to benefit from this approach. And melflufen may be an ideal choice for these types of patients because this is where IMiDs, PIs, etc., have run out of steam, they can be salvaged with melflufen. The other obvious point is that melflufen may move into where melphalan is classically used now, you know, in transplant and so on, because it could be that it's better. We'll have to see.
Fascinating.
And then, if I may, one thing, Neil, which is just to say that I want to make sure we emphasize the refinement of prognostics and MRD in guiding therapy, because prognostics are obviously accelerating. We've got some wonderful work by lots of investigators looking at better strategies to prognosticate. And MRD, of course, is emerging as an exciting new tool, primarily in the research arena. In other words, minimal residual disease negativity versus positivity. My only word of caution about MRD is that, you know, is it ready for primetime clinical practice? I would be careful because, for example, in our own work with our French partners looking at the timing of stem cell transplant, MRD negative patients still relapse at a rate of around 20% at 3 years. So is it an absolute flagpole for guiding treatment? In the research arena, yes, it may well be, but in standard practice, I would say it may be helpful to know it sometimes, or a patient may be reassured to know. But as a holy grail, I think one has to be a little bit careful. I think we've got to let things evolve a little bit before we start sort of recommending it for routine community practice.
Well, just to clarify that, the one practical potential use that you were referring to in terms of transplant,
yes,
you would think, I mean, it seems like if somebody were on the fence about transplant, maybe it was going to be a problem being out of work, et cetera, that maybe if they knew they were MRD negative, let's say from RVD or induction, they might be, you know, more comfortable holding off on it.
Yes, I agree. I think the important point is, though, that we're learning so much from the effort we've done with our French partners. As you know, the French arm of the study demonstrated no survival benefit to stem cell transplant early versus late, but did show a PFS benefit that was impressive, 14 months. But interestingly, no OS benefit, Neil. And I think that's an incredibly important message because it says several things to me. One is that you can successfully salvage people later. So to your point, your dad and a family who has a daughter's wedding 6 months from now may say, you know what, I'll keep my transplant in reserve. The second point is that if you have a big PFS difference and you successfully salvage, that may explain part of it, but it may not explain all of it. Because if you, you know, as you know, in most of our studies, like for example, Brian Dury's RD versus RVD, clearly a big PFS difference, and boy, a big OS difference as well. If you look at the most successful platforms, PFS correlates with OS. So why is it in transplant that we don't see an OS difference? I think salvage is important, but I don't think it's the whole story. And I think we have to recognize that kind of one size does not fit all. And what we do realize from our trial is that there are a couple of acute and late onset toxicity signals that we need to be aware of. Transplant, generally speaking, is very safe. Mortality rates related to therapy are less than 5% for sure, and typically less than 1% or 2%. But there is mortality associated with transplant, and we would be wrong not to be aware of it. I guess more worrying, though, Neil, to me personally, is that as patients live longer with myeloma, 15, 20 years, we're seeing this real specter of MDS-AML secondary to therapy. And that is a signal we saw in our French trial, albeit at very low numbers, but with relatively short follow-up. And I think we need to watch that carefully, Neil. And what we're doing...
Can I just clarify one thing that you said that kind of surprised me a little bit, which is the thought that transplant doesn't affect survival. I kind of had thought that the thinking was it's too early really to look at survival. Do we really know that it doesn't affect survival?
Well, I will tell you that from the French study, of course, which were an integral part, the follow-up at 4 years was very solid and there's no OS difference. Now, longer-term follow-up may show subsets of patients in whom OS is improved, but that will obviously require for subset analysis an OS difference that is real and achieves statistical significance. My only point about making that as a point to our audience is the clearly autologous stem cell transplant for the younger transplant-eligible patient is a standard of care, no question about it. The point is it's not the one-size-fits-all. That's the issue, that you can use transplant more judiciously, in my view now, particularly given this signal that in the longer term, you may have AML-MDS to worry about in a small number of patients. Second of all, and this is real, Neil, the tolerance of lenalidomide maintenance post-melphalan is not as good as if you don't have it in the mix. That's what we're seeing from our trial in the US.
Tolerance in terms of counts?
Counts, infectious complications.
Really?
Therapeutic dose reductions, etc. And when you remember that lenalidomide post-transplant generated 2.5 years median overall survival benefit, Len really does make a difference. So you can see where I'm going with this, Neil. As you think about the therapeutic sandwich that you're offering your patient, you may, if you'll excuse the metaphor, if your transplant's, you know, ham and cheese, you may want to move your ham and cheese back a little bit if you need to, because at the end of the day, you're getting your big mileage from your lenalidomide. So you see where I'm thinking with this. It's a concept that for patients is very attractive because it gives them choice. But I think it's not just choice based upon wishful thinking. I think it's choice based upon data.
One more question related to MRD, just more of a global question. Maybe this is just my ignorance. But when you think about the technology of next-generation sequencing in myeloma, where is it being applied? Looking for mutations, prognosis, or MRD, all the above?
All the above. All the above. I think it's, you know, it's a very exciting experimental tool, and I think that it continues to be in the research arena. But, you know, it's I think, again, shows great promise for our patients in the longer term.
You want to talk about your patient here?
Yeah, no, lovely. Well, this is one of a few cases I'd love to discuss with our audience because they kind of exemplify where we're going. This is a lovely lady who was originally diagnosed at the age of 62 in 2009. She had IgG kappa isotype. She had advanced bone disease, so she was a classic Dury-Salmon 3. She had ISS2 disease at that time, but if you use the revised ISS, she was clearly ISS3 because not only did she have an elevated LDH, but she also had deletion 17 positivity by FISH. So she would fall into a high-risk category by any measure now. The important past medical history or concurrent medical history that's relevant was she did have quite severe quite severe hypertension requiring triple therapy to control her blood pressure. She otherwise fit and well, and basically her initial treatment consisted at her local doctor's of lenalidomide and dexamethasone with zoledronic acid. We saw her and recommended the addition of a proteasome inhibitor based upon her high-risk characteristics, and she achieved VGPR with a very proactive approach to neuropathy using intravenous normal saline, partnering the steroids, using emollient creams and supplements with her bortezomib. We were able to achieve minimal neuropathy, just grade 1. She went on to autologous transplant. We mobilized her with high-dose cyclophosphamide at 3 grams per meter squared and then took her to high-dose melphalan at 200 milligrams per meter squared. She achieved complete remission. She really didn't want a proteasome inhibitor as part of her post-transplant mix, primarily because she didn't want to do anything other than a pill. So we agreed to that, although I did caution her and said, you know, I'm very worried about your deletion 17. You know, we're not perhaps doing the best here. But she said, Paul, bear with me. Let's give it a try.
Just out of curiosity, if that happened today, would you have given her exazimib?
Without a doubt. Without a doubt. Yep.
What will prompt you to switch to exazimib or utilize exazimib earlier, you know, maintenance, for example, or even up front?
Well, here, because, you know, she wanted a pill.
Right.
And because...
I mean, everybody would want a pill, don't you think?
Yes, but I think there's a more compelling reason for it as well. Exazimib really does give us the biggest delta we've seen in terms of benefit to deletion 17 positivity in randomized trials. The advantage in the Tourmaline trial for exazimib RD or exazimib lenalidomide dexamethasone compared to Len-Dex alone was staggering. It was at 10 months. Which is, you know, big PFS by any measure, Neil.
Could I just ask you a practical point? I think you mentioned Joe McHale a little while ago. I was talking to him, and I was asking about the GI toxicity. And, of course, you've had a lot of experience with exazimib. And what he told me was that in his experience, it's not uncommon and that it usually is only in the first month. I hadn't heard that before.
I agree with Joe. It's early and manageable quickly. You can dose reduce, obviously, 4 milligrams.
But I mean, is it common?
You know, it's low grade, but it's an important side effect because it's an oral proteasome inhibitor, but it's manageable. And you start at 4 milligrams weekly, Neil, and you can easily drop to 3. And a little bit of low-dose steroid goes a long way with the GI side effects and also, frankly, you know, appropriate supportive care. So in my experience, it's very manageable. It's not, I was particularly impressed by our prosamib, which was an epoxy ketone oral inhibitor. It was very active, but unfortunately, the GI side effects were prohibitive. You know, you had people on 3 or 4 antiemetics and really getting sick.
That's the carfilzomib oral.
Exactly. But that's not currently being taken forward. It's still back to the drawing board to kind of figure out how to better give it.
Joe told me that when he starts patients on exazimib, he gives them antidiarrheals and antiemetics and tells them about it, et cetera, et cetera. Do you do that?
Yes, you can. Exactly. You absolutely can.
Interesting. So this lady, let's see, where do we leave off here? She got transplanted.
Yep.
And what kind of maintenance did she get?
Well, she got lenalidomide maintenance 3 weeks on, 1 week off with zoledronic acid.
But you really wanted to give her, you would have given her what, RVD or what would you like?
Yeah, I mean, if she had allowed me to, I'd have given her bortezomib every 2 weeks, but she chose not to, and that's fine, completely understood. Nowadays, I would offer her exazimib, which would have met her need, which would have been oral. So nowadays, I'd have given her exazimib. In the context of what happened to her, though, Neil, it was very instructive. Her PFI was only, a progression-free interval, was only 1 year, and she progressed, which is a very bad sign in any setting. But it's particularly a difficult sign when someone progresses within a year on maintenance. Now, as a practice point for our audience, someone who progresses within 1 to 2 years and isn't on maintenance, that's not the same biology as someone who is on maintenance who progresses within 1 year. But for either group, you know, you worry about these patients.
So did she progress biochemically or also clinically?
Biochemically and clinically, she reported increasing bony discomfort and fatigue. So we added bortezomib, and she did actually respond to that. But obviously, it was aggressive bortezomib dosing. It was not every 2 weeks. We went in weekly, and then occasionally had to dial her up even more. But she had a nice response to the RVD platform again. But unfortunately, again, a short progression-free interval. Now, in 2012, I frankly wanted to give carfilzomib its due and try carfilzomib for her, ideally in a combo. The problem was her bad hypertension, and I was worried about that because obviously we have the vascular signal from carfilzomib. So we had a prospective clinical trial looking at pomalidomide, bortezomib, and dex, and actually she chose that because her neuropathy was minimal.
How much hypertension did she have?
Oh, she was on 3 drugs.
Oh, really?
And basically her baseline was 130, 140 over 80. And, you know, you basically worry about that because carfilzomib, as you know, can be associated with significant rates of hypertension. We believe that's because of endothelial actions that it has, which may also explain the DVT risk, the other things that we see with carfilzomib. So basically, and also may explain, obviously, the cardiotoxicity. So we believe in her that that was perhaps a choice we would have, but perhaps be kept in reserve. In any event, she went on to POM bortezomib dex on protocol, had a very good partial response, which was great. But again, classic for deletion 17 positivity, she was short, just 1 year. She progressed in 2013 with an aggressive relapse, and this was not biochemical, this was clinical. She had extramedullary disease, she really didn't feel well, she was really sick, and I was very worried about her.
Just out of curiosity, getting back to your early point about retesting patients, as she had these relapses, did you go back and see if she was still 17P or anything?
Yes, yes. On the protocol, for the 2011 progression, she asked us not to sort of poke her too much, so, you know, leave her in peace a little bit and see what happened. So we did. But for the 2012 relapse, we absolutely remarried her and did all the cytogenetics and flow. And sure enough, you know, she had plenty of 17P. I think a percentage, if my memory serves me rightly, was around 40%, which no one would argue with. That's enriched for 17P.
And just out of curiosity, what percentage do you need to sort of consider it 17P?
Well, I completely agree with Saga here. Any 17P is bad. I think there is a quantitative effect. 60%, I think you're in trouble. But I think anywhere in between also reflects that. I will share with you that in the tourmaline study, we did look at various cutoffs, and we showed that it mattered no matter whether you were 5%, 20%, or 60%. Having said that, clearly the worst was 60%.
Huh, interesting.
Yeah.
So what happened at that point?
Well, again, we thought carfilzomib because I thought, well, you know, I'm running out of options here and we just have to bite the bullet with regard to any vascular toxicity, perhaps, you know, put her on low molecular weight heparin, something like that, and hold our breath with the blood pressure. But actually at that time, we had the 501 study open and running in the phase 2 dosing with daratumumab at 16 mg per kg. And, you know, we had data. I mean, I basically had seen patients have dramatic responses with the antibody, and they could have horrible genetics and extramedullary disease. And so we basically went ahead and enrolled her, and she was on 16 mg per kg in the expansion cohort of that study. And bingo, she achieved complete remission, and she's been on it as monotherapy for over 4 years. And that's her quote to me this year, best I've ever felt since diagnosis.
At this point, how long do her infusions take? What happened with her first infusion?
Well, long infusion with the first, she tolerated it beautifully. She's now on basically 4 hours, I think around 3 to 4 hours. She's at the shortest interval you can give, and she's doing just fine.
Would you consider switching her to sub-Q, or you don't think it would make that much difference if it became available?
I think she's very comfortable with the routine, and I, you know, again, I'm very cognizant of her extramedullary disease, and I think that, as she and I sort of said to each other in jest, we're not going to mess with success.
Right. You mentioned before, incidentally, the high volume of sub-Q. Do you know what the volume is?
Yes, it's several hundred cc's.
Several hundred?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's a lot.
Yeah, yeah,
wow.
Exactly. Yeah.
Huh. So let me ask you, if you were to encounter a patient like this again, same exact clinical situation, you're about to treat the patient symptomatic, you know, 2-3 relapses in, what do you think the likelihood is that a patient, nowadays probably they wouldn't even get single agent, but just in terms of your global take on the data, the likelihood that a patient would get a response like this to single agent Dara?
Yeah, I think single agent Dara is very active, particularly if you use it earlier. I do this frequently where I'll start with Dara Dex alone and then add drugs to it as needed.
Hmm, interesting.
But if I have someone I'm very worried about, Neil, I'll go straight in with a triplet. Yeah.
Fascinating. I think you have a couple more cases. I don't know if you want to maybe pick one. I don't know how much time you have, but...
Sure. I mean, I think we could probably... I could be very quick about this case. This is a lovely gentleman with early relapse who basically got the combination of ixazomib and lenalidomide and dex. Basically, he had had a classic induction strategy with VTD, long history. He was successfully transplanted. He had thalidomide maintenance back in the day, did very well, actually. And then when he progressed on thal, we thought it very reasonable to offer him ixazomib len dex in the protocol-directed setting. His best response was a PR. Interesting, when we did his marrow testing, just real world, you know, we had insufficient plasma cells. But having said that, his response was very durable. And I just show this case because it shows the value of stable disease. He literally had stable disease for almost 2 years, but then he went to partial response and he's no complaints and working full time. So he's an interesting case because what he illustrates to you, Neil, we're 4 years in now, that basically he's MRD positive by anybody's measure, but look how well he's doing. And he is working full time and he has a normal, I would say normal, an excellent quality of life.
Getting back to what I was asking you about ixazomib, how did he do when he started out with it?
Very well tolerated, no major issues. This next gentleman is more remarkable, and he's another ixazomib case that I think is worth sharing because he actually received a BI week, twice a week schedule of monotherapy. But this was his background. Very nice man. He's actually British, but lives here. Basically, a very nice man. Had some interesting cytogenetic abnormalities at diagnosis. I did have 13 deletion by FISH. Lots of bone disease. And what he basically had in terms of therapeutic opportunity was he got bortezomib and dex to start with, which he did unfortunately develop significant neuropathy. This was where he was treated at UMass Worcester, where he got aggressive combination chemotherapy with platinum as well as bortezomib. Unfortunately, he did very poorly with that regimen. He perforated his gut and actually was in the ICU and had to have a defunctioning colostomy.
You think that, what do you think the perforation was from?
Platinum etoposide, adriamycin. Yeah. Yeah. It's very mucosally toxic as a combination. So he came through to transplantation in June, and amazingly enough, and very brave, but did it. And he did it with his defunctioning colostomy. And then he had that all re-anastomosed post-transplant. He went on to classic maintenance with lenalidomide, dexamethasone, and concurrent zoledronic acid. He really couldn't tolerate more melphalan and thought might have been carfilzomib potentially. But at that time, he really was very sick. He was exhausted. He was burnt out. His docs in Worcester were thinking about a second transplant, and he said, absolutely not. I should mention that with his transplant, despite having the functioning colostomy, he was in hospital for 40 days. So it was a long haul. I apologize. His hospitalization was a little less than that, not 40 days. It was a good 30 days. So my point is, it wasn't a traditional transplant where you're in for 3 weeks, basically. It was a bit longer. Anyway, he went on to maintenance thereafter, and essentially then progressed on maintenance within a year. So he was enrolled in a single-agent exazimib study, and what was really interesting was that, in essence, he came through with a twice-a-week drug orally. And again, this is a guy who'd have been a sitting duck for GI toxicity, Neil, but he wasn't, interestingly enough. He started in 2010 on exazimib, 3 milligrams twice a week. He achieved a minimal response, well, over time, over 3 to 4 years, but did really well. He then went into PR January 2014. We've dose reduced him to optimize tolerance, and he's down at 2.3 twice a week, and he's in sustained PR.
What were the tolerance issues that caused you to dose reduce?
Just a little bit of skin rash, actually, and some arthralgia, some GI toxicity, but minimal. And then basically where we have ended up is, this is a quote from him, feeling great and looking forward to driving across the USA in a Land Rover with his wife, because he's British, you see, hence the Land Rover as opposed to a Jeep. But, you know, isn't that a lovely story? So there's sort of two examples of how these new approaches can make a difference. And these are take-home messages around exazimib. This would be my closing comments, that there's a continuing evolution of multiple myeloma treatment, selected new classes and targets, and we've got a wealth of exciting options ahead of us with the vaccines, merizumib, the third generation IMiDs, the CELMoDs that I talked about. Obviously, the promise of melflufen, the excitement around selinexor, the real excitement around venetoclax, and then the obvious other drugs, the checkpoint inhibitors and more. And I just include nelfinavir because that is not produced by any company now, unfortunately, but it's a protease inhibitor that may have an effect on MEK. And in combination with bortezomib, it's very active. I just give it as an interesting example. It's an old HIV drug.
Yeah, you're right, HIV drug, that's wild.
And it was combined with bortezomib by some very innovative thinking from our Swiss colleagues. And in a relapse refractory population, they were able to show great responses.
So just one final question, and I think you mentioned it before, but I wonder if you could elaborate a little bit more about what we know about venetoclax and myeloma.
Yeah, well, obviously targeting 1114, but maybe doing more than that, and very synergistic with bortezomib. Just especially acknowledge Shaji Kumar and his team at the Mayo, who've really spearheaded the development of venetoclax. I think it's exciting stuff. It certainly seems to be active and well-tolerated, and it provides a targeted approach. So I think it sort of adds to the armamentarium in a very appropriate and promising way.
Can you describe a situation or where you would, or maybe you already have, tried to access venetoclax and give it to a patient outside a trial setting?
Yeah, I know of community colleagues who've done that. I personally have not, because we have a very strict policy in our pharmacy. But essentially, it's not impossible, because of course there's phase two information now, so it would be possible if needed. But essentially, it's been used in the setting of patients with 1114. But it also should be mentioned that, you know, it's active in non-1114s as well, if they've got any evidence of BCL2 mutation. So that's a reasonable thing to remember.
So actually, I was interviewing Dr. Kumar, and he kind of mentioned something about a BCL2 assay or something, and you just said BCL2 mutation. What is that?
Well, the idea would be simply that if BCL2 is targetable in your disease, if your levels are increased such that it may be an appropriate target.
But I always thought it was an overexpression. Is it a mutation?
Well, when I say an overexpression, I mean in the sense that exactly it's increased. And what I mean by mutation is that, in other words, there's an abnormality of it. Perhaps mutation is the wrong term. I would just say BCL2 overexpression is probably correct.
Right, yep. Right. And are there clinical assays right now that do that?
I would defer to Shaji on this one. I believe so, but I think that, again, I've not something I've done myself. We are entering clinical studies with venetoclax. My partner, Dr. Jacob Laubach, is leading those in our own group and taking those forward. So, and this could segue very nicely after what we just talked about. You know, I think there are certain take-home messages that we can talk about with exazimib as a focus. First of all, that proteasome inhibition is a standard of therapy for myeloma treatment, and I think that's exemplified by the survival benefits seen in pretty much every setting with the use of bortezomib, and the real excitement around carfilzomib, where we're seeing it provide clinical benefit of an order of magnitude greater than the seen with bortezomib, certainly as illustrated by the Endeavour study. Exazomib is the next step in this, in my view, because it's effective, it's safe, and above all, it's convenient, and it seems to be an ideal partner in a combination approach with oral treatments like lenalidomide. And there are studies now with pomalidomide that are very promising as well. It's given weekly, but obviously there is now efforts to look at twice a week, which was one of the takeaways from my patient. He's on the twice a week schedule with very resistant, biologically resistant, clinically resistant disease. And so he has done very well for a long period. And the twice a week schedule, therefore, in my view, is definitely worth thinking about. I think what's exciting about it is this concept of continuous therapy. Continuous therapy really matters. And this might explain, Neil, why you see the biggest delta in 17p deleted patients with exazomib compared to, say, bortezomib and even compared to carfilzomib, recognizing how potent carfilzomib is. The delta is almost 10 months, and that's the biggest seen in any randomized trial, to my knowledge. So that may be because you're able to dose it continuously. And we know that duration of exposure to proteasome inhibitor matters. For example, if you dose bortezomib to 64 doses, you see 17p overdriven. If you only give, basically for argument's sake, 16 doses, as the French did with the bortezomib dex induction, 17p is not overdriven. So that's where this principle may be so vital.
So just out of curiosity, if we were going to do a curve, and maybe there's a curve like this that exists, where you look at, let's say, drug levels over time, if you were to compare exazomib to IV bortezomib to sub-Q bortezomib, kind of what would those curves look like?
The convenience of exazomib exposure over time is huge because obviously patients stay on it, it's oral, it's easy. But in terms of actual curves related to dose and exposure, I can't recall those, Neil. I think in some ways we may be able to sort of look at them in a way of comparative trials. You know, for example, in the Aspire trial, carfilzomib was given for 18 months and then had to stop because there had no safety data beyond 18 months. And there you see the curve start to close again, suggesting that once you take away your proteasome inhibitor, things go south.
I mean, obviously that the duration of exposure for practical reasons, you know, if you can treat for a longer period of time. But I was wondering also within the treatment period, when you give, for example, IV bortezomib, obviously it peaks and comes down.
Yep.
Does it come down lower than the steady state of exazomib?
That's a great question. You know, there's a very interesting piece of pharmacology to exazomib. It's got rapid on, rapid off pharmacodynamics and kinetics. So it means that its half-life actually is reasonable, hence the weekly dosing. But the on-off effect is incredibly interesting because what it means is that you get this, and you also see effects on the subunits, which are different to bortezomib. So it's not, you know, bortezomib, people say exazomib's oral bortezomib. That's actually not true. They are both boronate peptides, but they are quite distinct. Whereas, for example, carfilzomib and aprosomib are probably closer to each other. Bortezomib and exazomib are distinct. But I would say that ixa has this advantage of this rapid on, rapid off pharmacology, which makes it less toxic in what it does. But I think you've got an excellent point there, Neil, that the half-life probably confers benefit. Interestingly, it's worth mentioning that bortezomib also has this Cmax effect, which may contribute to its toxicity, but interestingly also may be relevant therapeutically, particularly in extramedullary disease, because there have been some papers showing that when subcutaneous bortezomib may fail in an extramedullary patient, remember to try IV, because responses have been seen IV versus not seen with sub-Q, which are quite interesting.